Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 281 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing something I did in episode 243. Episode 243 was a podcast titled, What are Soluble Vitamins and the MBMEs? So in this podcast, I'm going to be doing fat-soluble vitamins and the MBMEs. Basically, it's just one of these things, you know, if you're taking step one, step two, CK, or step three. You'll see a bunch of questions on vitamins A, D, E, and K. And before I start, I just want to send push out reminders. So if you're interested in signing up for the step one course, it's a 30-hour course. It's from the 27th to the 30th of January 2021. Just shoot me an email through the contact button on the website. It's 30 hours and we'll use mini clinical vignettes. And in an integrated format, we'll cover pathology, physiology, pharmacology, biostats, ethics, communications, and things like that. And then if you're studying for step 2 CK, I have a 16 and a half hour course. It's taking place from the 7th to the 9th of January 2021. We're going to cover IM, neuro, surgery, peds, OB-GYN, psych, and then we're going to cover those November 2020 changes, right? So there'll be a lot of biostats, a lot of ethics, a lot of professionalism, a lot of error, a lot of quality improvement, patient safety, communications, and things like that. Okay, it's basically an expanded form of the 10-hour course that I used to offer before. And then I have a test-taking strategies course for the MBME on the 6th of January. So again, if you're interested in signing up for any of those things, just shoot me an email through the contact button on the website and I'll point you in the right direction. So let's just jump right into these fat-soluble. I just need to turn on the fan there for a bit. This is pretty toasty. So let's go ahead and talk about these fat-soluble vitamins, right? So the big things we know are, you know, there are two general classes of vitamins, right? There's the water-soluble vitamins. Those are basically your B vitamins. And remember, many of those water-soluble vitamins, we use them a lot as cofactors for many, many, many reactions, right? We use them as cofactors for reactions. And then the fat-soluble vitamins, they work more like inside the cell. They do a lot of things on the nuclear level. And obviously, one thing that your friends at the MBME love to go after with these fat-soluble vitamins, it's just how people get these deficiencies, right? Remember that fat-soluble vitamins, they're called fat-soluble vitamins for a reason. So whenever a person has anything that causes problems with the reabsorption of fat, so let's say a person has like pancreatitis, where your pancreatic duct doesn't work, so you don't shoot out lipase, or a person has like, like cystic fibrosis, for example, or celiac disease, where you've basically destroyed the villi in the terminal ileum, or like Crohn's disease, where you've just flat out destroyed the terminal ileum, you're going to have a lot of problems with reabsorbing these fat-soluble vitamins. So I think just to save time, so that this podcast is not very lengthy, I'm just going to go straight into vitamin A, right? So the thing is, I will really try to explain physiology in a fair amount of detail, but if you understand the physiology, then the causes of the deficiencies and all that stuff will be like a joke to you, pretty much, right? So again, understanding always beats just trying to straight up memorize things. Again, when you're using Anki, make sure you're understanding the things you're just memorizing. Don't just straight up memorize. Usually doesn't do people much good, right? So the thing is, for the most part, let's start with vitamin A, right? So how do we get vitamin A? Basically, vitamin A comes in as beta carotene in the diet, right? So you consume beta carotene in your diet, and then it gets converted to retinol, okay? And then that retinol, because that's almost like an alcohol can become an ester. But basically, you know, those esters of retinol, you can store them, you take them, that conversion happens in the GI tract. And then those retinol esters, you know, they travel as chylomicrons, and then you pretty much store the retinol or these retinol esters in the liver. Remember, it's actually very high yield to know this. The primary place where vitamin A is stored in the body is in the liver. Okay. And then when you need it, you pretty much just bring it out into the blood. You know, retinol is not going to be traveling in blood very safely, right? It binds to a protein that kind of keeps it steady. But once it gets into the cell, it gets converted into retinoic acid. It's almost like you're going from an alcohol to a carboxylic acid. That's an oxidation reaction, right? And then that retinoic acid can bind to response elements on DNA so that you can have changes in transcription and translation. So again, just simple pathway to try to understand, right? So again, most of the carotene most of the vitamin A we have comes as like beta carotene in the diet, right? And the thing is, if you eat, for example, like a diet that's like super, super high in beta carotene, your skin is actually going to turn yellow. And sometimes your friends at the NBA meet, they will try to see if they can trick you into thinking that the person is jaundiced, right? Remember, if a person has jaundice, their skin will also be yellow, but their sclera of the eye will be yellow, right? That's where this whole term of scleral icterus comes from. But people that have hyperkeratinemia, those people who have a yellow skin, but they have a normal sclera. Their sclera is completely white, so it's not a big deal. Just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And again, please, please, please don't forget this for any reason. This is absolutely important. Vitamin A is stored primarily in the liver. Okay, as you'll see, if you're a person that consumes a ton of liver from animals, you can actually develop a vitamin A toxicity. So why is vitamin A important? Well, vitamin A is important for quite a number of reasons, actually, right? So basically, it helps you maintain or like properly differentiate like very specialized epithelium, especially in the eye, right? Especially in the eye, as you'll see, when a person has a vitamin A deficiency, some of the epithelium in the eye, like those you find in the cornea and stuff, begin to undergo like weird metaplasias, and then that ultimately gives rise to eye problems. And then it's also important to realize that vitamin A is actually used to make something known as rhodopsin, R-H-O-D-O-P-S-I-N, right? So rhodopsin is one of these pigments you find in the eye, helps you receive light, right? Remember, those pigments, kind of like photosynthesis, their job is to pick up light, right? It's basically the most sensitive pigment that picks up light in the eyes, rhodopsin. And again, vitamin A is used in its synthesis, right? So the reason why rhodopsin is important is, and it's very sensitive, obviously, when it's dark all around you, then because there's so much dark and so little light, you want to be as sensitive as possible in picking up that light. So is especially important, this rhodopsin is especially important when you want to see like when it's really dark around, you know, like at night, for example. So it's very important to not have a vitamin A deficiency. If not, that can cause a lot of vision problems like night blindness, for example. So why can people get vitamin A deficiency? Well, it's pretty easy, right? People can get vitamin A deficiency, again, if your diet is not rich in vitamin A. So if you're not eating all these green vegetables are super, super rich in vitamin A, right? And also, again, obviously, if you have a fat malabsorption, basically any fat malabsorption disorder, Crohn's disease, celiac disease, all that stuff, right, that can cause fat malabsorption, right? And don't forget these drugs that they love to test on MBM exams, these bile acid binding resins, like cholestyramine, cholestipol, cholecystevalam, right? Those things can also cause a malabsorption of those fat-soluble vitamins, just FYI, to keep in mind for exams, right? So we've talked about how people can get vitamin A deficiency. Well, how can you get super toxic with vitamin A? That's actually pretty easy, right? Again, if you consume a ton of liver, right? Consume a ton of liver, right? Like these Eskimos, for example, right? Like they eat a ton of liver from like all these animals that survive in the winter, like polar bears and things like that. If you eat a ton of liver, like a diet that's super, super high in liver, that's actually going to increase your risk of having vitamin A toxicity, right? And also another classic way people get vitamin A toxicity on NBM exams is obviously if they are taking isotretinoin for acne, right? Can cause a lot of problems. Remember, vitamin A is, if you take too much vitamin A, that can kind of mess up your Hox genes. And if you remember from the podcast this morning on brinchial arches, right, you'll begin to see that those people have like weird orientations of things in the body, like the appendages being in like weird places, right? So again, that's why you literally need to be on two forms of birth control before you're placed on isotretinoin for acne. And again, isotretinoin for acne is always like last line treatment, right? Now, the thing is, the way I'm talking about vitamin A, so people may be like, oh, divine, vitamin A must be really bad. No, vitamin A is not bad, right? I mean, it has some good uses. Obviously, we use it to treat acne, right? But another thing with vitamin A that's particularly important is that we use it to treat acute promyelocytic leukemia, right? Remember, acute promyelocytic leukemia, that's the one with the 15-17 translocation, that has those hour rods inside the affected cells. Remember, it's a blast cell leukemia, right? It's an acute leukemia, so it involves blast cells. So the thing with blast cells that makes them like, oh, really bad to have those mutations is blast cells divide, right? So because they divide, they almost intrinsically have a property that will make them very favorable from a malignancy perspective, right? So the thing is, if by some magic you could take those blast cells that have hour rods and differentiate them all the way to neutrophils. Remember, neutrophils don't live for long. They live for like 1 or 2 days and then they'll undergo apoptosis and die, right? So the thing is, if you give a vitamin A derivative, right, or transretinoic acid, it will convert those blast cells, those leukemic cells, to neutrophils. And then those cells will undergo apoptosis and die off, right? And then you're done. Because you're basically taking, curing the cancer by forming a cell that cannot divide from a cell that can divide a lot, right? So that's another use for vitamin A on NBMEs. And then don't forget, if a person has measles on NBME exams, right? Again, obviously, if a person has measles, you could have prevented that by getting the vaccine in the first place. But if a person has measles and you're trying to treat them, obviously, there's no great treatment. It's just supportive care. But if you want to reduce the morbidity, especially blindness associated with measles infection, you want to go ahead and give vitamin A. Giving vitamin A really, 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 really helps. It actually reduces the morbidity. And the big thing is just blindness, right? Like, again, some people, if they get measles, usually these people tend to be like super malnourished. So if you would give them vitamin A, you know, that may prevent them from, you know, going blind in the first place, right? Which is obviously what we want, right? So again, what are the big findings with people that are deficient in vitamin A? Again, they're going to have night blindness, right? Because again, the epithelium of your cornea is not going to be maintained, right? So if it's not maintained, it'll become squamous epithelium, right? So you essentially undergo like a squamous metaplasia, actually, when you have a vitamin A deficiency in the cornea. And again, that can ultimately lead to problems with night vision. And again, if you can't make rhodopsin, then that light sensitive pigment at night is not picking up light. So you're gonna have a lot of problems, unfortunately, right? And also, if you're looking at the conjunctiva, right? So remember, normally the conjunctiva is one of those weird places where you find pseudostratified columnar epithelium, and actually has like some goblet cells, right? So pseudostratified columnar epithelium. The thing is, you can actually also undergo squamous metaplasia. So you go from that pseudostratified columnar epithelium to squamous epithelium, right? And those things actually are the things that cause betel spots, right? Because all that keratin around that epithelium, that's the thing that causes betel spots in the eye in a person that has a vitamin A deficiency, right? So again, that's why these people get blindness, because they just have like the rhodopsin is not being made. They have all the squamous metaplasia with the cornea and with the conjunctiva, right? So that impairs these people's vision, right? Now, the thing is, when you have, I think one particularly important thing with these vitamin deficiencies is, don't just look at it from the deficiency perspective, also just look at it from the excess perspective, right? So when you have too much vitamin A on board, right, that's something called hypervitaminosis A, right? What can it cause? Well, the thing is, it can actually cause an increase in intracranial pressures, right? So when you have high ICP of vitamin A toxicity, right, that can cause like papilledema, that can cause blurry vision, can cause headaches, right? I mean, if this sounds an awful lot like an obese woman that has morning headaches and blurry vision, right? Remember, that's pseudotumor cerebri. These days, it's known as idiopathic intracranial hypertension, right? But basically, right, you can get very, very big increases in intracranial pressures with vitamin A toxicity. I mean, that's why they love to give these questions in sort of like idiopathic intracranial hypertension in women that have acne and are taking like acne medications like isotretinoin. And then they tell you that, oh, the person has been having a lot of morning headaches, blurry vision, papilledema on physical exam. If you see all that stuff, I want you to think about vitamin A toxicity, right? And the thing is, vitamin A, again, remember, it works at the genetic level. So it actually activates osteoclasts. And it actually even makes you just make more osteoclasts. And obviously, if you're making more osteoclasts, you're going to be resorbing bone, right? So you can get all these pathological fractures and stuff, right? So it's actually very high yield to know that vitamin A toxicity can actually present as you know, just a person having fractures, having like a lot of bone pain, okay? Having a lot of bone pain. So again, super, 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 super important to keep in mind, right? Super important to keep in mind on exams, right? And the thing is, some of you may be like, Divine, does vitamin A only work in the eye? No, it actually works in many other parts of the body, right? Like, for example, think about it. In your bronchi, right, you have these ciliated columnar epithelium. The thing is, when you have vitamin A, is required to maintain that epithelial layer, right? If you have a vitamin A deficiency, that columnar epithelium may not be, ciliated columnar epithelium may not be maintained properly, so it can also undergo squamous metaplasia, right? And when you have squamous metaplasia, you're going to have a lot of problems producing mucus and all that stuff that's kind of necessary, right? Because you also don't have that cilia, right? So again, that actually makes the person more susceptible to infections, because that mucociliary clearance pathway is gone, right? So when people have vitamin A deficiency, it can actually increase their risk of having like just tons and tons and tons of pneumonias, right? So again, very high yield to know these things for exams. Again, I know you may be like, oh, Divine, you're going into so much detail on this, but I promise you, this stuff is floridly high yield to know for tests, right? So now let's go to the next fat soluble vitamin, right? So let's go to vitamin D. And an easy way to remember these fat soluble vitamins, just use the mnemonic ADEK, right? ADEK, and then you're good to go, right? So vitamin D. So the thing is, especially for step one, knowing the metabolism of vitamin D is super important, right? It is super, super, super important, right? Now, let me try to explain this. If you understand this, again, vitamin D will make perfect sense to you. This is something they absolutely love on NBM exams. Now, let me tell you this. The big thing you want to remember is that all roads lead to cholecalciferol, right? I'll say that again. all roads lead to cholecalciferol. Cholecalciferol is vitamin D3, right? Cholecalciferol is vitamin D3, right? So how, what are some potential roads that get you to cholecalciferol? Well, one is you just eat vitamin D in your diet, right? But the thing is, the vitamin D that comes from your diet, especially like a plant-based diet, is going to be known as ergo, E-R-G-O, calciferol, okay? Ergocalciferol, right? Ergocalciferol. So that ergocalciferol you get from your plant diet, you know, can be converted by in the body to cholecalciferol, right? But a very important source of vitamin D is in your skin, right? Remember, your skin has this thing called 7-dehydrocholesterol, right? 7-dehydrocholesterol. When you get your, that's why they say, oh, go and get the morning sun, go and get the morning sun. Well, the thing is, the 7-dehydrocholesterol in your skin can be converted to cholecalciferol, right? In fact, that is how you make most of your vitamin D that's, like, you know, made in the body. Now, there are some other minor pathways, but that's beyond the scope of our discussion, right? So those are the two roads, right? So ergocalciferol from your diet, or 7-dehydrocholesterol from your skin, and then sunlight converts that to cholecalciferol. That's vitamin D3. Well, what then happens to that vitamin D3? Well, that vitamin D3 goes to the liver, right? Some cytochrome P450 enzymes, yeah, like 25 hydroxylases. They basically help you make 25 hydroxy vitamin D. That's calcidiol, right? And then that calcidiol then travels to the kidneys, right? Travels to the kidneys. And under the action of 1-alpha hydroxylase, you know, you convert that calcidiol, or the 25 hydroxy vitamin D, to calcitriol, which is 125 dihydroxy vitamin D. And remember, this actually happens in the proximal convoluted tubule. Okay, this is floridly high yield to know. This process happens in the proximal convoluted tubule, right? And how does parathyroid hormone relate to all this business? Well, don't forget, right? PTH actually makes you make more 1-alpha hydroxylase, right? So if you make more 1-alpha hydroxylase, then you obviously you're going to make more calcitriol, right? And then don't forget, as an integration, right, they can give you an African-American woman that has been having chronic cough for the last few months and has hypercalcemia. Well, what's the mechanism there? She obviously has sarcoidosis. When you have sarcoidosis, the thing that's going to happen, right? Remember, those, it's a granulomatous disease, right? You have those non-caseating granulomas. Those epithelioid macrophages that surround those non-caseating granulomas, they produce a ton of 1-alpha hydroxylase, right? So, and that 1-alpha hydroxylase will make you make more calcitriol, so you get hypercalcemia, right? Because you are essentially having a hypervitaminosis D, right? And again, don't forget, because calcitriol, right, the active form, that's the active form of vitamin D, is a steroid hormone, is steroid derived, right? Again, it acts on the nuclear level, right? Acts on the nuclear level. So I guess, what are some functions of active vitamin D? Well, the big things to remember, right? It basically helps you reabsorb calcium and phosphate in the gut. That's kind of like the big thing, right? And the thing is, that calcium and phosphate, it helps you reabsorb from the gut. It basically maintains a solubility product, right? So for those of you that, you know, took MCAT in the past, you probably remember KSPs, right? The solubility product equation. So it basically helps you get the appropriate solubility product of calcium and phosphate, so that you can mineralize osteoid. Remember, osteoid is laid down by osteoblasts, right? So when you mineralize that osteoid, you then form strong bone, right? So obviously, you can begin to see that if you have a vitamin D deficiency, you're not going to be able to mineralize that osteoid. Osteoid is very soft, so you're going to have very fragile bones, right? That's what happens in people that have rickets or people that have osteomalacia, right? So what are some things that can make people have a vitamin D deficiency? Again, if you understand the pathway I just described, you're pretty much good to go, right? So again, obviously, if your kidneys don't work, really pretty much on MMA exams, if a person's kidneys don't work, that's like the most common cause. Actually, to be honest with you, that is, in the real world, the most common cause of a vitamin D deficiency, right? Kidneys just don't work, right? Because again, remember, your proximal convoluted tubule doesn't exist, so you have no 1-alpha hydroxylase, right? And also, again, if you don't expose yourself to sunlight, so if you live in a place where there's not much sun, right, or you're a person that's dark-skinned, right, you have a very high risk, or, you know, maybe you're a radiologist. Oops. If you're a radiologist, right, that, you know, never sees the sun, you have a pretty high risk of vitamin D deficiency as well, right? Because again, that 7-dehydrocholesterol to cholecalciferol conversion is not, it's not really happening, right? And obviously, again, if you have like fat malabsorption for any reason, it's going to cause a vitamin D deficiency. If your liver doesn't work, right, because again, you're not making calcidiol, right? Remember, cholecalciferol is converted to calcidiol in the liver by some cytochrome P450 enzymes, right? And then also, if for some reason those cytochrome P450 enzymes have been induced, a person can also get a vitamin D deficiency, right? Because if you think about it, right, like vitamin D, so many people think that calcidiol only goes towards calcitriol. That's not true. Calcidiol can actually be made into an inactive metabolite, right? And whenever you induce cytochrome P450 enzymes, you're going to make more and more and more of those inactive metabolites from calcidiol, right? So whenever you have anything, like if you're like a chronic alcoholic, or you're a person that takes phenytoin or barbiturates or rifampin or graziofulvin or St. John's wort, right? So they can give you like a herbal supplement question there, right? Or carbamazepine, right? Those things are all cytochrome P450 inducers. Those things can actually, if you take them on a chronic basis, it can actually lead to a vitamin D deficiency, right? And also they can give you like a pediatric question of a kid that has vitamin D deficiency, and basically it will just be a kid that is just being exclusively breastfed. Remember, kids, they actually need supplemental vitamin D, right? Because breast milk is actually super, super, super low in vitamin D, right? Breast milk is actually super, super low in vitamin D. So again, that's really high yield to know for exams, right? So again, what are the bad things that happen when a person has vitamin D deficiency? Again, you're not going to be able to mineralize osteoid. That's the key problem, right? So when you're not able to mineralize osteoid, you're going to get problems with, like, you know, very soft bones, right? So these kids, they may have like cranial tibies or cranial tabes, wherever, depending on what part of the world you come from, right? Like very soft skull bones, right? They have like bone of their tibia because, again, their bones are very soft. You can have this thing called the rachitic rosary, right? The rachitic rosary is just basically like unmineralized cartilage, right? At your costal chondral joints, right? And then, you know, they can have like frontal bossing, right? And these are all findings in rickets. Rickets is vitamin D deficiency in kids. In adults, you won't see the cranial tibies, you won't see the rachitic rosaries, because by the time you're an adult, I would really hope that you've already mineralized those cartilages, right? But in adults, you're going to see these people having a lot of, they will have very soft bones. So they have like a ton of, pathologic fractures, right? As adults, right? That's osteomalacia, right? Osteomalacia. So again, just high yield to know these things. I think if you understand what I've described, you should be pretty good from a vitamin D perspective. And again, this podcast is actually coming to an end, right? So let's just talk about, or just say a few quick words about vitamin E and vitamin K, right? So vitamin E, the big thing you want to know about vitamin E is it's an antioxidant, okay? It's an antioxidant. That's super important. It's an antioxidant. Basically, because it's an antioxidant, right, it prevents a lot of free radical-based reactions from happening in your body, which is good, right? Because free radicals, they cause a lot of damage, right? So, for example, like your cell membranes get very, very, very easily damaged by free radicals, right? Because you're basically those free radicals, like the peroxide radicals, can really oxidize the lipids of your cell membranes and completely destroy them, right? Or if you're even looking at it from a cholesterol perspective, remember, LDL is not intrinsically bad. It's the products of LDL that are bad for you, right? So that LDL can be oxidized, right? The oxidized LDL is the thing that can then ultimately be taken up by macrophages. You form all these foam cells and they form atheromas and all those things. Well, vitamin E prevents the oxidation of LDL. So you don't form that oxidized LDL, right? So obviously, again, like I've said many, 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 many times, right? Fat malabsorption will cause a fat-soluble vitamin deficiency, right? So if a person has like cystic fibrosis, for example, or a person has like chronic pancreatitis where their pancreas doesn't work, so you're not making any lipase, that's obviously going to cause a fat-soluble vitamin deficiency, like vitamin E deficiency. But a very high-yield critical one to know in MBM exams, right, is A-beta lipoproteinemia, right? So remember, when people have A-beta lipoproteinemia, their chylomicrons are made, but they're not able to get those chylomicrons out of the gastrointestinal enterocytes, right? So because those chylomicrons are accumulating, like they have vitamin E, but it's in the GI, is in the enterocytes where it's like not useful to you, right? So those things can all give rise to vitamin E deficiency, right? So what can vitamin E deficiency cause? Well, think about it. Again, if you're not able to protect your membranes, right, then your cells are going to like keep rupturing, right? So these people can have like hemolytic anemias, right? Because again, their red blood cells keep rupturing. Just again, that those free radicals, because that antioxidant effect is not there, those free radicals will just damage the red blood cell membrane, right? And then you can also have this free radical damage to like myelin and to like neurons. So these people tend to get like problems, especially with the spinocerebellar tract, right? So many times when people have vitamin E deficiency, they tend to have a lot of ataxia, right? They tend to have a lot of problems with like the just think of it as problems with the spinocerebellar tracts. They also get like dorsal column problems, right? So those are kind of like the big things to know with vitamin E. Now vitamin K, which is our last one, remember vitamin K, for the most part, how you get vitamin K, it's your colonic bacteria that help you make vitamin K, right? You can already begin to see that if you take broad spectrum antibiotics, kill your colonic flora, you're going to have a very high risk of bleeding, right? Because your vitamin K doesn't work, right? So your colonic bacteria, and also if you eat like a lot of like dark green vegetables, those things are pretty rich in vitamin K, right? So the thing is, whenever you, that vitamin K though is not useful yet, you need to, you know, do some conversions with it. The conversion that happens is there's this enzyme in the liver called epoxide reductase. Epoxide reductase basically helps you make the active form of vitamin K, and then that active vitamin K can then do its anticoagulant duties, right? So I mean, if you're trying to make a pharmacological integration here, warfarin, right? Warfarin works by inhibiting vitamin K epoxide reductase, so you don't convert vitamin K to active vitamin K, right? So why is vitamin K important? Well, vitamin K is important, especially the active form, right? Because it does this whole thing that we know as gamma carboxylation. So what is gamma carboxylation? Well, gamma carboxylation is basically something that happens with some proteins, right? Like factors 2, 7, 9, and 10, and protein C and S, right? So you have that gamma carboxylation. When they're gamma carboxylated, they're able to bind calcium better. And if they can bind calcium better, then they can go ahead and basically play their procoagulant roles, because remember, calcium plays a big role in the coagulation cascade, right? So the thing is, if your vitamin K is not around, well, you're not going to be able to gamma carboxylate factors 2, 7, 9, and 10 and protein C and S. So you're going to have a lot of problems. Remember, C and S are anticoagulants, but 2, 7, 9, and 10 are procoagulants, right? But we'll kind of see a few things about that story in a moment, actually. So what can cause vitamin K deficiency? Again, if you understand the pathway, it makes a ton of sense, right? So basically, if you take broad spectrum antibiotics, right, going to kill off your entire colonic flora, right? And, you know, in addition to the C diff problems you'll get, you'll also very likely get a vitamin K deficiency, right? And remember, when kids are born, they need to get an iron vitamin K shot, right? Because remember, your colon is actually not colonized by bacteria until like your 6th day after you've been born, right? So many times they will give you this question about a kid that had a brain bleed and the kid was born at home by some, you know, unqualified health professional, or just born at home, straight up born at home, and then the kid starts having like a subdural hematoma or whatever. Just think of something called vitamin K dependent bleeding. That's what was previously known as hemorrhagic disease of the newborn. Okay, hemorrhagic disease of the newborn. And then remember, how can people get vitamin K toxicity? Well, think about it. If a person's liver doesn't work, well, there's no more vitamin K. I mean, actually, I take that back. What is one other thing that, some other things that can cause vitamin K deficiency? Well, if your liver doesn't work, right? Because that's what logically makes sense, right? No vitamin K epoxide reductase, you're not going to be activating vitamin K. So you're going to have a huge problem with bleeding, right? That's why people that have end-stage liver disease, they tend to bleed a lot. These people, when you're doing surgery on them, you better open your eyes, better know what you're doing, right? And also, like, they can give you like a poisoning question. If a person takes rat poison, rat poison is basically warfarin, right? So you'll inhibit vitamin K epoxide reductase, so you'll not be able to activate vitamin K, and the person gets in trouble. And again, when a person is getting warfarin toxicity, well, how do we fix that? You know, don't forget, you know, back in the day, they used to do fresh frozen plasma. That's not what's done on NBMEs anymore, right? Remember, these days, you do 4-FPCC, right? So the four-factor prothrombin complex concentrate, right? So remember, again, warfarin, we kind of know the way it works. You know, inhibits vitamin K epoxide reductase, so you prevent the gamma carboxylation of 2, 7, 9, and 10, and protein C and S, right? But the thing is, factor 2 has a super long half-life, but protein C and S, they have a super short half-life. So the effects you'll see, like, almost within a few hours of taking warfarin is that your CNS have fallen out of circulation, right? So your CNS, those are anticoagulants, right? So transiently, 2, 7, 9, and 10 will have, like, very, like, they'll almost be winning the battle over CNS, right? When that happens, right, you have a slightly procoagulable state. That's why when you're taking warfarin, you need to start with heparin, right? You need to bridge the person with heparin first before you go ahead and start a treatment, right? So again, just vitamin K, obviously, if you have a vitamin K deficiency, you're going to bleed, right? You're going to have ecchymosis on the skin. That's a high yield thing to know, right? And remember, because vitamin K is important for 2, 7, 9, and 10, remember, factor 2 at least, we know this, is like the intersection point of like the two coagulation cascades. So these people's PT and PTT will both be elevated, right? But there will not necessarily be any effects on the bleeding time, right? So hopefully that makes sense. Sorry, this podcast has, you know, gone on for longer than I want to, but I think I'm going to go ahead and maybe end now. I feel like I've said pretty much all I want to say and made all the high yield integrations I want to make. So please subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. You get a notification whenever I make a podcast. And I do offer one-on-one tutoring, step 1, step 2 CK, step 3, preclinical med school exams, 30-day shelf exams. I also tutor for the MCAT and actually tutor medicine residents as well for like the training exam, the medicine boards. So if you need tutoring for any of those things, just reach out to me, hit the contact button on the website, and I'll give you some more information. I tutor people primarily through Zoom, right? And then please subscribe to the podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts, it's on Google Play, it's on Spotify. I mean, it's on Google Podcasts and on Spotify, right? It's called Divine Intervention Podcast. And then I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcast and Videos. So please subscribe to that. And then if you want to sign up for any of these Step 1 or Step 2 CK courses that I'm having in January, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll be more than happy to point you in the right direction. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I will see you next time. God bless you.